I'm sure will make many people very happy. The first word in the title starts with an A. And so this is about the dark matter abundance. And just to remind you of what I'm going to be discussing, the observed ratio of dark matter over baryons, which I'm going to call zeta, is about 5. Okay? And the question is, where does this number come from? And since I've already used the A word here, let me just say that I'm going to be talking about a very specific context where I think that these, where I think that entropic reasoning is quite well motivated. And I'll try to explain carefully what that context is. But first, I'm going to give a brief outline where I'll be somewhat sloppy. So don't attack me right now. You'll have your chance later. But first, let me just give a very rough outline of the talk so you have some idea of where it's going. So I'm going to be combining several ingredients. The first one is the strong CP problem. Okay, the classic solution to the strong CP problem is the axion. There are other solutions, but this is a particularly nice one. And it's one which arises naturally in string theory as well. In the axion solution to the strong CP problem, you have a dimensionful parameter, F axion, which is called the axion decay constant. And in many classic guts, and also in many string theory models, this dimensionful parameter is between 10 to the 16 GeV, or about the gut scale, and somewhere around the Planck scale. Okay? And certainly in string theory and also in model building, you can arrange for other things. But there's a large class of models like this. Now, there's only one problem with these models, and that is cosmology. And as I'll explain, the axion acts like dark matter today. And the value for this ratio is some number around 10 to the 11 times. So I'm just talking about our universe here in this. I'm not changing any other couplings or anything. So you have this ratio of the axion scale to the Planck scale. And then you have this axion misalignment angle, which is generically order 1. Okay, there's nothing to dynamically determine it in the early universe. And the usual assumption is that that's order 1. There's no natural explanation for this being something different than 1. So the usual conclusion, and okay, so this would give a very large number, much bigger than 5. If this is order 1, and this is somewhere in the range that I'm talking about. Okay? Now, I'm going to be, concrete, so the usual conclusion is that we need F axion to be less than about 10 to the 12 GeV in order for this to give a reasonable answer. So I'm going to persist, though, in considering these models with this high-scale axion and just ask, what's the prediction for the observed dark matter ratio in that context? And to be concrete, you could change some of the assumptions here, and it'll be obvious how you could change them. To be concrete, I'm going to talk about a situation where we have eternal inflation occurring in some false vacuum. This eternal inflation ends by some bubble nucleation process. And then inside here, we do our ordinary slow roll inflation. And then here we are living somewhere up here. Okay. So this is just a particular assumption about what was going on before our slow roll inflation started, you could make many other different assumptions which would lead you to the same conclusions here, but I just, well, I particularly like this one here. Okay, so the context here is eternal inflation, many different bubbles. Now, in this situation, the value of theta is approximately constant in each bubble. Okay, but it's randomly chosen every time a bubble nucleates. Okay. Some of them will collide, but if the tunneling rate is small, then that's a very rare process. So I'm in the eternally. Well, that's true. We can talk about that. That's true. I mean, we can talk about that in more detail. I agree. Quantifying in what sense it's a rare process is difficult, and I have thought about that. But I think that's somewhat a side point right now.
Are you assuming that it is one?
I'll get to that. I mean, at this point, these things wouldn't have omega exactly equal to one because you have negative curvature here. But I'll assume enough equal so that it will be virtually one. Okay, so this axion misalignment angle takes values which are just stochastically chosen in these different bubbles. So in this. With these assumptions, what's the prediction for the observed dark matter ratio? Okay. And let me say right now that there's a large caveat here, which is that we need to regulate the infinities of eternal inflation. There's two different infinities here. One is that an infinite number of bubbles are produced if we're in the internally inflating regime. The other infinity is that each bubble is itself an infinite open universe. So there's two different infinities. And if you want to object to everything I'm going to say on the grounds that this is not completely rigorous, I will agree with you. This is something we need to understand far better before these anthropic arguments can be on a completely firm footing. Okay. Yes, right.
So, how
very plausible. Right. So what I'm going to use here is a plausible method of regulating these infinities, which is called the causal diamond method, which was invented by Raphael Busse. Okay. And basically, that cuts off these infinities by simply focusing on the backward light cone of one geodesic. Okay, so that gives a finite number in each one of these bubbles. Okay, and I could go into how it regulates the infinity in the number of bubbles, but basically, it does it in exactly the way you would expect, where each value of this initial angle is equally likely.
Sorry, is the past light cone of the observer at infinity, or is it
yes.
The past light cone of somebody like us?
No, someone at infinity.
Why?
So you go up to future. That's the proposal.
Why do I care about somebody billions of years in the future?
Well, I mean, I think the motivation, I mean, I don't really get too involved in defending this. This regulator has not been derived. I would say the motivation is that, you know, thinking about black hole physics has motivated us to focus on the causal path, which is usually defined as the backward light cone of future infinity. It's not going to make a large amount of difference for us here, but that's the yeah. So sorry, in this picture it's clear. There's some surface where we're living here, and then there's future infinity, which is farther out here, and it's the backward light cone of that. Which we'll be considering.
Could there be anything other than a period of slow roll in that region? I mean, why does it matter if it's, I mean, once we've exited slow roll inflation, isn't that good enough with this?
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're asking which backward light cone I'm going to use, or what?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's the same, but another way to say this is if you're happy to do that, that's great. So now we're not talking about eternal inflation anymore. We're just talking about the past of one region, which happens to have inflation.
That's right. The only function of eternal inflation here, you could probably set this up without even talking about eternal inflation. The only function of eternal inflation is to produce all these different bubbles with all these different initial misalignment angles. That's its only function. Okay, so if you're willing to just say we start in a quantum state with a random superposition, that's equally good. My own project is that understanding eternal inflation is more promising than understanding the initial conditions, but you know, that's not obvious. Okay, so this is what I have in mind, but anything which gives you a flat prior distribution for this angle is fine. And it'll lead to equivalent results. Okay, so, right. So with this measure, I mean, okay, most of these bubbles have far more dark matter than we observe. Okay? But there's also very few observers in those bubbles, because once there's too much dark matter, as I'll show, there's very few observers within this light cone here. Okay? So so what I'm gonna find is that using this regulator, 30% of observers in this model form in regions with less dark matter than we see, and 70% form in regions with more dark matter than we see. So our observation is quite typical. It's in the central 50% of this distribution. And, you know, I'll mention at the end, I mean, this is, okay, clearly this is not going to persuade people who are anti-anthropic, because it's a rather broad prediction. It's not even a prediction, because we've already measured this quantity. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about the end, about possible observational and confirmation of these ideas. So my main point here is that with a couple of plausible assumptions, eternal inflation, an axion with a large decay constant, and a particular regulator, which has worked very well so far, I find that this model is complete, is in that, that our observations of the dark matter abundance are quite typical. So I hope to convince you that these models are worth considering. And it's certainly possible that the explanation for the dark matter abundance is not anthropic in this way. That's also a possibility. In this particular theoretical context, it is a statistical anthropic prediction. And I hope to convince you that there's nothing internally inconsistent about this as far as we know right now. Okay, so that's the basic outline here. And so now let's go into a little bit more detail. The strong CP problem, I mean, I'm sure everyone has heard these words many times, but let's just remind ourselves what this problem is. You can add a term to the QCD Lagrangian, which is some constant in front, which is not determined by anything, times the integral of F wedge F. Okay, not F wedge star F, but F wedge F. Now, this violates CP. And experimentally, by measuring various electric dipole moments and so on, we know that this value is less than 10 to the minus 10. Okay? We know that CP is not a good symmetry of nature, but it appears that in the strong interaction, CP is a good symmetry, at least at the level up to 10 to the minus 10. So the classic solution to this problem is called the Peche-Quinn axion. And so basically, we add a dynamical field so that some terms in the Lagrangian, we still have this integral of F wedge F. And then I'm going to call the axion theta. So you have a dynamical field which couples to F wedge F. This field will turn out to be periodic with with period 2 pi, so I'm going to use theta for it. And then this field needs to have a kinetic term, which looks like this. And in order to make the dimensions work out, you need a dimensionful parameter there, which is called the axion decay constant. Okay? And at the level of writing this down, this is a free parameter. Okay? So the first thing that this accomplishes is that clearly this value I put out front here is completely meaningless because I can just redefine this angle. Okay? So we can completely forget about this term by a redefinition of theta because there's a shift symmetry here. And then the value of theta is determined dynamically. So there's an effective potential for theta, which is determined by integrating out these interactions. And what this looks like, I mean, by the way, there's going to be order one factors destroyed throughout this talk. So the effective potential for theta looks like that. Okay, and this is the QCD scale, which is around 200 MeV. Okay, so this is some rather mild potential at rather low scales compared to what we normally think about in cosmology, a few hundred MeV. Okay, and you can see that the minimum of this potential is at theta equals 0. Okay, so this dynamically sets theta to 0. Okay, and that's the classic solution to this drawing CP problem. There are others. Let me just mention one thing here, which is that if you want, we'll be interested in the mass of the axion. To find the mass, you would rescale the field so that the kinetic term looks canonical. And when you do that, you find that the mass of the axion is the QCD scale squared divided by F axion. That just comes from rescaling the field. Okay, so high scale decay constant means very light axion. Okay, so now we need to come to the question of what is FA? What is this axion decay constant? So there's many guts where FA is the gut scale. And in string theory, well, so this is a paper from 2005 by Svercek and Ed Witten. I'm just quoting an authority here. Many string models give FA too large for the standard cosmological bounds. And in fact, the value FA equals 10 to the 16 GeV, or something relatively near it, arises in a number of different models. This value corresponds to an axion frequency close to 130 kilohertz. Most models we consider lead to FA in the range from 10 to the 15 GeV to the reduced Planck mass. Okay, so most models that Ed Witten is aware of in 2005 are in this range here. Now, there's certainly other models available. This is not at all a statement that this is the only thing you can do in string theory. There's just a natural set of models where you have this range of decay constants. Okay, so this is all great from the point of view of particle physics. There's only one problem, which is cosmology, as I mentioned before. So let me draw the potential for the particular situation I'm imagining. But as we discussed, you could change some of these. So I'm imagining a false vacuum, a period of slow roll inflation, our universe down here with positive cosmological constant, and then ultimately a decay to some kind of true vacuum, although that's not going to play any role here. So this tunneling field doesn't really have to be the inflaton, but for ease of drawing, let's imagine that situation. So here's the inflaton potential. Okay. And now I'm going to imagine that the total potential is the inflaton potential plus the axion potential. And remember that the axion potential is this thing. Okay? So the axion potential, well, maybe I should draw it here. Okay, it's periodic between, let's say, minus pi and pi. And it looks something like this. I guess that should be. So this scale here is, you know, 200 MeV. And I'm imagining that these scales are much larger, the inflation scale and so on are above, or, you know, it doesn't matter too much what the inflation scale is, but I'm imagining, you know, GeV or higher, or much higher. Okay. So that's the situation. I'm assuming that the total potential has this tiny axion piece and this big inflaton piece here. Okay. So this axion potential is irrelevant until after reheating, when the temperature drops to a border MeV. Okay. So I'm going to assume everything, inflation, reheating, and so on, happens above a GeV, which is a very standard assumption. Okay.
Question. Was that decoupling between those two sectors? I mean, is it reasonable to think that the axion, you know, is still the same axion you're talking about when you're, say, up at 10 to the 16th GeV or wherever you are in the slow roll potential?
Well, yeah.
But that's the assumption.
Good. I mean, so good. So the assumption here is that the energy scale of inflation, so let's call it the slow roll, okay, is somewhere below F axion. Okay, if it's below F axion, then we have a right to think that F axion is also the scale where this Peshek-Quinn symmetry is broke. Okay, as long as we inflate well below this scale, then you know, the symmetry of the axion is completely unaffected. And then I'm going to assume it's much bigger than the QCD scale.
So this is the V to the fourth of the energy.
Yes, sorry. Yeah. So this is the range of slow roll, and I'll assume some reasonably efficient reheating. It doesn't really matter. But this is the range that I'm going to be interested in.
There's also a decoupling. I think Rob's asking about decoupling in the sense that the axion symmetry itself would have said that you could have made every parameter in your inflaton potential a periodic function of theta. And you're not doing that. You're making the math, so you're sequestering the two sectors from each other.
Well, right. I mean, I think that's the natural assumption here at these kinds of energy scales. I mean, the assumption. Look, in order for the Peshek-Quinn axion to solve the strong CP problem, it needs to not couple to anything else that's going to give it some potential. Okay, so it's important that you have an axion whose shift symmetry is primarily broken by this coupling. Okay, so even just at the level of particle physics, it's important that this field doesn't couple to anything else.
Even if that stuff was CP invariant? So I thought all you really needed was a CP invariant.
No, you need the shift, you need an almost unbroken shift symmetry. Because otherwise, you know, theta will be set to some other value.
Yeah, so couple it in a U1 invariant way.
You want to couple derivatively, or
no,
what?
I'm thinking squared, basically, the length squared of the axion.
No, I withdraw. No, I think what I had in mind would have broken the symmetry.
Okay, well, let's come back to it. I haven't spent ages thinking about, you know, model building axions, and I would be interested to talk about it more. But I think this is a natural assumption here.
So just to be clear, I mean, why is theta randomly distributed? Because the quantum fluctuations in theta are quite small.
Well, that's right. So, but the point is, it's eternal inflation. So you're sitting around in this false vacuum for a very long time. Okay. So let's just focus on the potential here. You have some minimum here. You have this angular direction whose potential is completely irrelevant. So you just stochastically populate every every value.
Turn inflation is a very strange thing, as you know.
Yes.
The initial conditions, you can regard them as living on an infinite null surface.
That's right.
Your pass, and it's not clear to me that correlations on that initial surface would not survive inside the bubble. In other words, are you simply putting initial conditions of theta as random in each bubble?
Because
the physics is not naturally doing that for you.
Well, in a sense, it is. I mean, so we start out. So you wanted to say put initial conditions here. That's fine. So if the initial conditions here are phi equals some, let's say pi over 8 or something.
Exactly.
Just pick something. Okay. So then, as you evolve, the field phi. The field theta is essentially massless.
I know the magnitude of the fluctuations in theta are h over m flat, the Hubble constant in inflation, whereas the length that's got to go is f axial, and so it's actually not.
Yeah. So what I'm assuming here is that if you wait an extremely long time and you go up to some much later slice here,
why do we live in a bubble that was a very long time after?
Well, so if thinking about eternal inflation is the right thing to do, it's because eternal inflation erases initial conditions. Now, if you're going to say to me, and what you would say is, okay, well, most of the volume is up here, blah, blah, blah. Now, if you're going to say to me, maybe initial conditions are important, maybe we live in an early bubble, then I completely agree. This argument doesn't suffice, and we're just going to talk about a different theory where the answers depend on the initial conditions. Okay.
But even if I'm in a late bubble, I'm seeing this huge surface on which theta is 5 or 8. Are you sure that if I live in...
No, I mean, look, just follow any given Hubble patch, okay? As you say, the fluctuations are h over m Planck. Wait an extremely long time, it will have random walked and completely distributed its value everywhere. It's just a random walk in every single Hubble patch. But that is the assumption, is that we can focus on very late times and that eternal inflation is effective at erasing initial conditions. But, but any theory, so this is...
Another comment, I'm on your side this time, is that when you said it won't go very far, didn't you assume that the Hubble scale was the Hubble scale of inflation rather than the Hubble scale of the false vacuum? That he hasn't told us what that Hubble scale is.
So it would be low because the CMB and anisotropy would be big.
In the false vacuum?
No, I mean, any false...
Well, you can't have it very high.
Well, look, let's come back to this.
Okay. There's whole tuning issues, but if you keep... I mean, you were saying the scale of inflation could be 1 GeV, in which case that will come up.
Well, look, okay, I don't care. It can be between a GeV and 10 to the 14 GeV. Anywhere in there is fine with me. And this thing can be basically anything you want as long as you have enough inflation to wipe it out. So I mean, I would agree. But in any case, let's not get hung up on this. This is some question of initial conditions. My favorite candidate for saying initial conditions is eternal inflation. But if you have a different one, I think it's still going to be homogeneous in theta. Okay.
All right.
So now, so let's talk about the cosmology of the axion. Okay. So the axion satisfies some equation of motion, which looks like this. And I'm going to focus on values of the axion rather close to the minimum here, and you'll see why I'll do that. Okay, so I'm just going to work in the quadratic approximation. We could generalize this, but it would not be illuminating. So for values of theta rather close to the minimum, this is the equation of motion. Okay, and so if you analyze this, you'll find that the value is frozen until about the time that the Hubble constant is equal to the mass of the axion. Okay, so whatever initial value you start out with in this bubble, it's frozen there until this time. Okay, at that point it begins to oscillate. It's a homogeneous field that's oscillating, and you can show that the time average, the short time average of of theta squared goes like 1 over a cubed. Okay. The energy here, we're in a region where the potential looks like this. Okay, so the energy in the field redshifts like 1 over a cubed. Okay, so this redshifts like dark, like matter. And more generally, the axion acts like dark matter. Okay, so let's compute the dark matter ratio now. Let's compute it. So what I want to compute is at the time that this thing begins to oscillate, the ratio of the dark matter energy density to the baryon energy density. Okay, this is our, and you know this is constant at this point. So let's compute this ratio. So the density of dark matter at the time it begins to oscillate is given by this formula for the potential energy. Now, the density of baryons is equal to the mass of the baryon, which is about 1 GeV, times the, this seems like a silly way of doing it, but so I'm holding everything fixed, as in our universe, except possibly this amount of dark matter and axions. So I'm going to write in terms of the number of photons, because this is an easy way to compute what this ratio is. Okay, so it's the baryon density compared to the photon density times the density of photons. Okay, so so this is 1 GeV. This number in our universe is about 10 to the minus 9. And the number of photons, number density of photons, is T cubed, the temperature cubed at this time. Okay, and this happens during radiation domination. This happens during radiation domination, that the temperature, that the Hubble constant gets small enough for this thing to start to oscillate. And during radiation domination, we have a relationship between the Hubble scale and the temperature with M Planck in here. Okay. And if we could say solve for the temperature in terms of the Hubble constant. Okay. So the temperature at this time is h squared m Planck squared. And the time we're interested in is the time when the Hubble constant is equal to the axion mass. So this is the axion mass squared times m Planck squared. Okay. So now we can compute this ratio. The dark matter density was this thing. And the baryon density is 1 GeV times 10 to the minus 9. Times T cubed, and let me, I don't really want this mass of the axion hanging around, so let me remember this formula here, that the mass of the axion is related to the QCD scale and the axion decay constant. In this way, so the temperature at the time the axion begins to oscillate is this thing. Okay, so basically the axion is very sneaky. It's frozen out, so it only redshifts like vacuum energy. In other words, it doesn't redshift until this time. And you can see that there's an F axion in the denominator. So if F axion is rather big, this happens at a rather low temperature. So a lot of evolution has already happened during which the axion was not redshifting. Okay, so I can put this in here. I have lambda QCD cubed. I have the temperature cubed here. And then I have M Planck over F axion to the 3/2. Okay? So Okay, so then this gives the final formula for the dark matter ratio. The dark matter ratio, if you get all these factors right, is something like 10 to the 11. And then you have this factor of Fxn over M Planck to 3 halves. And then you have this value of theta squared here. Okay, that's just simplifying that formula right there.
I had an introduction. But can I ask a naive question about, I mean, you froze the baryon to photon ratio.
That's right.
But baryogenesis, at least, well, my understanding of baryogenesis has something to do with CP violation. And at the high scale where baryogenesis happens, you have this big theta angle. And so therefore you have a lot of CP violations. So can you really assume that the physics of the axion is decoupled from the physics that gives you the 10 to the 9?
Well, that's a good question. And I mean, there's various models for baryogenesis and so on. And it could be that in some models, you're correct that the value of theta actually affects the baryon to photon ratio. So I'd be very interested in talking about that further. But there's at least some models where it's not, you know, where the physics of the axion is decoupled. That's a good question. So this is the value for the dark matter ratio, and it's generically very large if we have a high scale axion and theta takes a generic value. And let me just mention that there's no dynamical way to set theta to zero because the physics in the early universe has no clue about where the zero of this axion potential is. Everything is happening at much higher scales. Okay, so the idea that there's some sort of dynamical mechanism in the early universe is hard to believe. And there's no model like that I'm aware of. Okay, so as I said, I'm going to just insist on keeping the axion at a high scale. And I'm going to ask what the prediction is for the observed value of this dark matter ratio. Okay, and I guess I can go back to the picture. So in the situation where you're producing all these bubbles, I would say that it's quite natural to say that the probability of seeing a value of theta between theta 1 and theta 2, which translates to a dark matter ratio, is proportional to the number of observers that are formed in that value of theta. Now, let me just mention that we do use this argument sometimes in context that everyone accepts. For a stupid example, if you want to predict from first principles where we live in the galaxy, you know, there's no other argument for it except that, well, we live in a place that's hospitable to making observers. I mean, most of the galaxy is made out of empty stuff. Okay, there's no other equation to solve which will determine that we live on an Earth-like planet other than counting the number of observers.
What's an observer?
Well, yeah, that's one of the things that needs to be far more well defined. I mean, in this context where the only thing that's changing is the amount of dark matter, I have some concept of intelligent life, which is really just based on the one example we're familiar with. But this is something that would need to be far better understood. But you know, what I'm going to assume here is rather generic stuff, that you know, galaxy formation is a good thing for producing observers. So it's going to be, I'm going to only need extremely rough properties here.
What's the logical difference between making that argument you want to make and replacing it with an argument simply of the form, we observe that galaxies have formed abundantly in our universe, and therefore we draw a deduction from that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say the difference is that here, I mean, here we have a particular statistical prediction. I mean, it depends on how much you want to put in. I mean, if you want to say we've already observed the dark matter ratio, then there's no probability distribution I can write down for it. But I think in principle, it makes sense to use the theory to predict you know, both quantities which have already been observed and quantities which have not yet been observed. I mean, this is not...
But I think, I mean, for there to be a difference between your logic and the logic I just specified, and the logic I just specified would lead to the conclusion, if the dark matter is an axion and if the scale of the axion is high, then the angle theta is very small, because we also know that galaxies are formed. If you want to claim you're doing something that's different from that, you have to get some other kind of prediction or implication.
Well, I would say the difference is that, you know, without making the statement that this is the right way to compute probabilities, you would say, well, if F axion is so high, why are there so many galaxies?
And the answer will be the theta is very small.
Well, but then why is theta so small? Okay, so it's unnatural for theta to be small unless you have some kind of weighting factor which tells you, okay, theta takes all its different values, and the value we should expect to observe is the one which is fairly typical among places where you can form flux. So it's just a different computation for naturalness. I don't quite see what the analogy would be for the galaxy. Okay, great. To give a slightly less stupid example of a context where I don't think anybody would object to this sort of reasoning, we could ask, what is the, you know, there's all kinds of solar systems. We can even look out and see them, and we're seeing them better every day. Okay, so presumably we could have lived in many of these solar systems. Okay, so you can ask the question. You know, is there some way to predict the eccentricity of Jupiter? Okay, now clearly if you know all the initial conditions, the location of every gas particle, you can predict the eccentricity of Jupiter if you have enough computer time. But I'm talking about in the context where, you know, galaxies form in some kind of stochastic way, they form differently everywhere. There's solar systems with different Jupiters, with different eccentricities all over the place. Now, there's three possible explanations here. One is that there are some equations which lead you precisely to the eccentricity, which is 0.048. Okay, not any probability distribution, just a number. A second possibility is that the eccentricity is fairly typical, it was just randomly chosen, say among gas giants. Okay. Another possibility is that it's typical among gas giants in solar systems with Earth-like planets. Okay. Now, the recent observations, or over the last 10 years or something, have indicated that the eccentricity of Jupiter is not actually typical among gas giants. Most of the Jupiters that we observe have a much larger eccentricity. Okay. However, most of those will not have Earth-like planets in their solar system, because a very eccentric Jupiter tends to expel an Earth-like planet from the solar system. Okay. Now, I don't know if this is 100% established, but I think we would agree that this is a possibly correct scientific explanation for what the eccentricity of Jupiter is. And it's a scientific question of whether or not this is the correct one. Okay. And for this to be correct, it's important that, you know, given the prior distribution for the eccentricity and the bound that allows for an Earth-like planet, the eccentricity takes some reasonably typical value. Okay. Otherwise, I think we would look for some sort of dynamical explanation. Okay.
So, are you not just giving a dynamical explanation? That is, you know, in a solar system, initially there's a mass, and then it evolves, and objects with high eccentricity are expelled, and they're not stable, and then, you know, what's at the end of the process are just small eccentricity objects.
Which is no, 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 no.
So that's,
you know.
The point is, if you look out, most of the Jupiters have far higher eccentricity than our Jupiter.
Yeah, but as you say, there's initial stuff in your solar system, gas and debris and planets. Then
sorry, it's not a question of initial conditions. The point is,
not the initial conditions. Just the questions that. I mean, people run simulations of the solar system over a large period of time, and you see that. You see this cleaning effect that lots of things are just expelled and ejected, and there are very few things that, in fact, stay inside the solar system.
Well, that's correct. The statement
it's
here.
It's just a dynamical explanation that you start from a mesh.
No, sorry.
There's an attractor.
No, sorry. That's not correct. The statement here is if you would take a lot of things with the right initial conditions to evolve to things like our solar system. Most of the things would evolve to systems with a rather eccentric gas giant and no Earth-like planets. That's the statement, okay?
And that statement based on the idea that the ones that we have seen have larger eccentricities?
Yes.
So look,
I'm not an astrophysicist. The astrophysicists claim that these selection effects have been taken into account and so on. And I don't really care whether this is the correct explanation for the eccentricity of Jupiter. The point is, it's a scientifically viable explanation, and it's one that we can consider. And just evaluate whether it's the correct one or not.
This is certainly a scientifically correct explanation. The question is, how would it be if we only observed the solar system we lived in, and somebody proposed this as an explanation, beginning with there's a large number of other solar systems, and they have orbits formed by some random dynamical process. The question is, how reliable,
right.
It happens they would be right, but
right.
How reliable the scientific argument would
right.
This stand as evidence for the existence of this other world?
That's right. And I would certainly say the same thing here. We need to amass a pile of evidence here, not just one or two predictions, in order to believe this sort of, I completely agree with that. So let me repeat the caveat here, which is that here we have infinities. This situation we do not understand theoretically as Jupiter. Okay, and I think that is one major reason that people are more suspicious of these arguments, and that's fine. And I think this needs to be put on much firmer theoretical ground. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to use this causal diamond measure again. I'm going to count things inside here. Okay, so then I'm going to get a probability distribution for the observed value of this displacement angle, which is going to be equal to the prior distribution times the number of observers inside the causal diamond as a function of theta. Okay, now this prior distribution is flat. Okay, and remember from here that the dark matter density is proportional to theta squared. Okay, so I'd rather write this in terms of the dark matter ratio. Okay, so what I have is a flat prior distribution for the square root of this ratio, and then this weighting function, which is the number of observers as a function of the now the question is, how do we compute this thing? Okay, and I'm going to find it useful to divide this into two pieces, the number of observers, that's the number of baryons, times the number of observers per baryon. Okay, that's a correct equation. And now, first I can compute this number of baryons. Okay, that's easy to compute. I can compute that in the homogeneous approximation here. And if I didn't mention it before, I'm assuming enough slow roll inflation that this is virtually a flat universe. Okay, and since I'm running short on time here, I'm just going to compute the number of baryons at the time t lambda. Okay, I can compute it as a function of time, but Let's just compute it at the time t lambda, the time when the vacuum energy starts to dominate. Okay, and I should mention that this is set by the cosmological constant. It has a very tiny dependence on the dark matter ratio, but it's basically a constant. And there are more rigorous arguments in my paper, but anyway, let's just compute this thing. So at the time rho lambda, by definition, the matter energy density is equal to the vacuum energy density. Okay. This is all matter here. That's the definition of the time t lambda. Now, also the horizon size at lambda domination is also set by the de Sitter length scale. Okay. So the volume inside the horizon goes like the cosmological constant scale cubed. Okay? So the total mass inside the horizon is equal to the volume of the horizon. So this quantity is independent of the ratio. Okay? The total mass inside the horizon is this volume times this matter density. And the matter density is equal to lambda. So this quantity, the total mass inside the horizon at the time of lambda domination, is independent of the dark matter ratio. Therefore, the mass in baryons, which is proportional to the number of baryons, is equal to the total mass, which does not depend on the dark matter ratio, divided by this quantity 1 plus zeta, okay? Because the ratio of the baryonic mass to the total mass is given by this ratio here, okay? So the bottom line here is that the number of baryons is proportional to 1 over 1 plus dark matter ratio, okay? Now, let me just mention, it seems counterintuitive because we weren't removing any baryons. We were holding fixed the baryon to photon ratio, and we were just adding in dark matter. Okay, but the effect of that, because we have a flat universe, is to increase the Hubble constant. Okay, because you have some equation that looks like h squared is g times rho matter plus rho radiation plus rho baryon. So if you increase the amount of dark matter for fixed photon and baryon densities, you're going to increase the Hubble constant, and those baryons are going to get expanded away from each other more quickly. Okay, so the number of baryons inside the horizon has this dependence. Also, just the density of baryons. If you're not using something fancy like this regulator, just the density of baryons also has this behavior. Okay, I mean, this is the density on very large scales. Clearly, on smaller scales, it's determined by, you know, complicated dynamics. So now, we need to compute the number of observers per baryon. And this is something which is rather difficult. And fortunately, there's only 1 minute left. It's been argued about extensively. And to just summarize the literature, Tegmark, Aguirre, Reese, and Wilczek conclude that number of observers per baryon is basically a constant in the range of dark matter ratios between 2.5 and 100. Okay? They just conclude that galaxies can form more or less as they do now in that range. For too little dark matter, you have problems forming structure because the dark matter is, you know, is the thing that starts structure formation. With too much dark matter, this bound is controversial. It has to do with cooling and disfragmentation and so on. And Hellerman and Volker conclude that it's constant as far as they can determine, up to 10 to the 5. Okay. So there's a big difference in the numbers here. And this has to do with, you know, simulating galaxy formation it also has to do with the fact that we don't really know what the requirements are for forming life. Okay, so, but the answers here are not actually going to care very much whether we use an upper bound of 100 or an upper bound of 10 to the 5, because we have this weighting factor, one which just tells you there's fewer baryons. Okay, so it's not going to make a big difference. So it makes sense to plot things as a function of the square root of the dark matter ratio, because that's the thing that's uniformly distributed. Okay, there's a lower cutoff, which is at the square root of 2.5. There's the observed value, which is square root of 5. Here's the upper limit of Tegmark et al., which is at the square root of 100. Okay? Now, this probability distribution in that range just has this 1 over 1 plus square root, and it looks something like this. Okay? So now, the sensible thing to do here to compute whether our observation is typical is to compute the amount of probability on either side. And what we find is that there's 30% on this side and 70% on that side. Okay? Now, with this alternative assumption, let's actually go even farther. Let's just allow observers to form efficiently for arbitrarily large dark matter ratios. The only effect of that would be to change this 30% to a 25%. So this prediction is rather insensitive. I mean, there's clearly other uncertainties which are more important than whether or not you can form observers at dark matter ratios bigger than 100.
Well, it's not a prediction. I mean, it's just you've got such a flat distribution that you can't really predict anything.
Well, I mean,
if you have a narrow distribution, you can predict something.
Well, I mean, the prediction of this, so the natural value for the dark matter ratio in these models with high scale axions, you know, is somewhere out here. Okay, so, you know, the prediction of this theory is that you see an unnaturally small dark matter ratio. And to address your question about the width of this distribution, 68% of the distribution is less than a dark matter ratio of 15. So, but I completely agree. I mean, first of all, it's a rather broad distribution in the range of things we observe, although it's not a broad distribution compared to the theory of high scale axions. And in addition, it's already been observed. Okay, I mean, the prediction for lambda was also rather broad. But, you know, it was a prediction. And you get a lot of points for that. So how are we going to convince ourselves that these ideas are true or that they're false? The key thing is going to be a combination of observation and experiment. In terms of observation, these axions have distinctive isocurvature fluctuations. These can either come from the false vacuum before inflation, or they can be generated during inflation if the inflation scale is high enough. So this is a possible detection, which would give us some information. It's also possible, I mean, there's laboratory searches for dark matter, and it's quite possible that we'll find out about the axion in laboratory searches. So the main conclusion here would just be that these simple models with high-scale axions, which are very attractive from the particle physics point of view, are quite in agreement with our observations of the dark matter ratio, and they shouldn't be ruled out on cosmological ground. And clearly, it's crucial to understand in a more rigorous way, you know, eternal inflation, how to regulate these infinities, so that we can actually make sense of this in a more rigorous way. Thanks.
Okay, then two comments. I mean, it's you know, it's clever, but everything depends on the argument for the choice of the measure, which had to do with this causal diamond from the future thing. If I wanted to make a different anthropic argument, and I wanted to choose the measure being the number of civilizations within a megaparsec, just because I like a megaparsec, Then that NB would be flat, as you said, you know, that they're the same number of planets, et cetera.
Well, I'm sorry, are you going to count the number per megaparsec averaged over the visible universe?
No, just within a megaparsec of where I happen to be. Because I like to hear from you.
True. In that case, you're going to get a prediction which agrees less well with.
Because I'm going to get rid of the 1 over 1 plus, say,
that's right.
And that's just going to be flat. And I'm going to be, and we're going to be less typical.
That's right.
So I mean, it seems to me this is a generic argument that one always runs into with these kinds of things, which is that at some point somebody says, "I like this measure," and it gives me something that I like. But you know, there's no argument for that. And the consequence of that, I mean, when you say this is observationally testable, I mean, what's observationally testable is that there's a very light axiom with a high scale with a small theta angle.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And that's an interesting prediction. If I believed in a string theory model or generically in string theory enough to really want to take seriously high scale axions, I would be forced to say if that is compatible with the existence of galaxies, then mm-hmm. the theta angle is very small, and that's a prediction. And I would say that if, you know, it would give more credence to certain string scale or string kind of models of the axion, but it wouldn't remotely give more credence to eternal inflation or anthropic arguments. Where are these observations to be seen? That is, if this is the way the world is with this kind of axion, then it makes models that have these kinds of axions more plausible, but I don't see that makes the argument that you're making more plausible.
Well, I would say, you know, something that's going to make people believe in eternal inflation in the multiverse essentially is going to be a number of predictions for a number of quantities, combined with a theoretical understanding of the priors for those quantities, and you know, it would involve the dark matter ratio, the scale of the axion, the cosmological constant.
But my argument is stronger. My argument is that everything that you think would serve as evidence for eternal inflation, multiverse, actually is logically equivalent as far as the real logical force of the experiments to confirming something about our universe and the particular model that describes our universe. The rest is not. Every argument of the form of assume the multiverse, assume the anthropic principle, blah, 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 you get a prediction. In the intermediate stage, make some assumptions just about our universe, and I could cross out the first two lines and have a perfectly good scientific argument. So by the Oxen's razor, the first two lines aren't doing anything.
Well, I think it's a question of understanding naturalness in this context. And, it's true. You could put in all the data about our universe and then you would have fewer things available to predict. And, I mean, to answer your previous question, I would just say that there's more of a chance that the horizon has a fundamental significance in quantum gravity than that 1 megaparsec does. So there is some motivation for using this. If you're willing to just say, well, I don't care whether things are natural, I'm just going to put in that our dark matter, that we have less dark matter than is natural, then this explanation doesn't do anything for you. But if we assemble a convincing set of arguments of this form, then I think it's going to be more persuasive. And in addition, the thing which would make a huge difference is to see some kind of signals from the beginning of inflation, which would give us some kind of hint that there is some eternal inflation going on. Okay, and I think that's the thing that would really address your concern. And I don't know whether that's going to be possible, but I think that's a very interesting question.
Another question or comment? Okay, let's hang.